You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Heal Thyself by Dan Adler. William soon hit the peak of his own celebrity. "So your name came up from my cousin, sending me screenshots of your Instagram, and then other people just sending me your name," Kim Kardashian told him on the 2019 episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. He proceeded to tell the reality star that copper in her liver was causing outbreaks of her chronic psoriasis. Stephen Novella, a neurologist and the founding editor of the site Science-Based Medicine, sees William as part of a lineage of health-oriented operators, including Casey and Franz Mesmer, the late 18th century physician who practiced hypnotism and befriended Mozart and Marie Antoinette. "People who are either wealthy or celebrities aren't necessarily scientists or even very smart, and so they become targets," Novella says. "These kinds of people will prey upon them because they know that their endorsement is worth a lot." William's non-famous clientele also span a spectrum of belief. While there are die-hard converts, such as Tisson, there are those who approach his practice with something of a wink. There are happy customers and vocal proponents, as well as those who have gone all in on the medical medium but walked away unsatisfied. Dee Sclafini, a piano teacher in Richmond, Virginia, discovered William in 2013, the same year as Tisson, when she suddenly couldn't make it through one of her regular runs. She soon found William online. Sclafini initially viewed William in messianic terms and proposed to him that she make a documentary about his life. She referred friends to him, and one decided that she would book a session as long as Sclafani would join her on the call to calm her nerves. But Sclafani drifted as the cumulative consultation fees ballooned and he became scarce. "I tried these supplements and spent a ton of effing money." "You're coming from a desperation energy," she says, "and that's not a good energy to come from." "Bro, I'm not doing good at all," Tisson texted William in July 2017, back in excruciating pain. "It's been weeks, but way worse now. Sorry to bug you." Hours later, she wrote, "Thank you for your support. And yeah, I think the stress you mentioned is financial stress. Praying for that to come to completion. I love you and I appreciate all you do for me." Tisoni sent photos of bumps on her skin a few days later and asked if she had shingles. William said she had baby shingles, which is what the back prob was originally, and advised her to take vitamin C and lysine. Tisson sought out a number of other alternative health practitioners to address various subsets of her symptoms. She spoke remotely to Teshna Bouillot, a chiropractor and a self-described specialist in quantum neurology and neuroemotional technique. Tianco Ting, the author of Natural Qi Movement, Accessing the World of the Miraculous, and several medical medium devotees. Tisson conveyed many of the assessments she received to William. In August, Tisson couldn't get up. She had been sleeping on a mattress on the floor at her parents' house, and her back pain had become unmanageable. She kept the lump from her family, later texting William that she was not up front with her father because his sister had breast cancer. Tisson discussed the growth and all other manner of health issues with others. But at this moment of crisis, she went directly to William. They exchanged 156 voice messages between August 30th and September 3rd. They discussed several opinions Tisson had by then received and whether she would get an MRI. She did not at that time. As her concern grew, Tisson often back-channeled to try to understand the thicket of health ideas contained in William's messages and phone calls. Sweetheart, in your audio, you said Aunt didn't know why you have nausea, Casey McCluskey texted her. But he does know. Maybe you didn't hear him correctly, love. Do you want me to text you the reason? McCluskey says that all of Tisone's friends knew that her nausea was from migraines. Did you ever have a lump in your breast? Tisone texted McCluskey in July. I think I told you I have one, right? Since March. Yeah, you told me, McCluskey responded. It will go, just takes time, especially while you're having a viral flare. Stephanie had told me during that time that she had seen a doctor multiple times, McCluskey says. She also told me she had a viral issue. By this point, Schutzman had already told Tisone breast lumps can be lymph or node-related, but that she should have it looked at, and Ahmed had spoken about it with her. A couple of weeks later, Tisone reminded William of the lump. She became unable to work. Her father, a manager for government construction projects, covered most of her health cost, and a friend sent her money throughout 2017 to buy supplements. That August, she stunned her health community friends by missing the annual Woodstock Fruit Festival, and one of them came to visit her. She shared with the friend that she had a breast lump, but assured her that she was talking to William. Sorry to bug you again, but these things I am legitimately worried about, Tisone texted William toward the beginning of October. She was vomiting and her throat was starting to feel swollen. Think we will find a doctor to come to house, he wrote. Let's look tomorrow. If you get so bad and can't breathe, you can always call emergency, he said a few minutes later, but I think it's just acids burning throat. I don't have a good feeling about having a doctor come here to draw blood, Tisone texted. She didn't have health insurance and didn't want to get trapped and fall down the rabbit hole. I understand, he responded. How is it? Tisone had spent nearly two decades in the alternative health ecosystem, and by her own account, it's difficult to get a full picture of the advice she followed. Just want to make sure you know I don't have a doc that's overseeing all this, she later texted William, just a mishmash of random people. Her reliance on this community was broader than William, but time and again she returned to him. Haven't heard from Anthony, Tisone texted a friend and former William assistant, but Tianco says there is a virus in my intestines. She asked William if a chiropractor correctly identified her slipped disc, and he said she did. She told him that Bouillot had used her neuro-emotional technique over FaceTime. Yay, he responded, adding, that can help a sensitive, nervy girl like you. Tisone followed up a few days later about whether she should get blood work, and William said she should because her sodium level could have dropped from vomiting. She said she was vomiting less and asked if she still needed to. William responded in a series of voice messages. You're dealing with the shingles virus, tried and true, like 100%, he said in one. I mean, that's the virus that flared up your disc, everything else. If a doctor could come and draw blood, he said, it might make her family feel better. I think your family really needs you to see you get at least a little support, he said, adding, they could lose perspective over time, even though it's a slipped disc keeping you from getting up. Later that week, Tisone's nipple began to bleed. She sent William a photo of stains on her shirt and asked if she had a hiatal hernia. You didn't have one months ago when I looked, he responded, but now that you vomit this much, it's possible. When she asked what he thought of her bleeding from my left nipple on same breast, a cyst, he responded, I'm not liking that at all, but don't want you worried right now. Just get your back better. As your back gets better, then the vomiting should stop. It should come together. He told her the bleeding probably didn't have to do with the cyst. It had been about 7 months since Tisone texted Schutzman about a lump in her breast. William and Tisone had exchanged hundreds of text and voice messages about her health. According to the phone records reviewed for this story, William never told her not to see a doctor. On at least several occasions, he suggested she seek other medical help. Over the same period, he told her he could do a bacterial scan on her, and she asked him to ask the spirit of compassion if there was anything pressing on the nerves that we can't see with an MRI. Tissonne wasn't getting any better. She had blood drawn the week after her nipple began bleeding and told William that her breast was throbbing where the cyst was. "When did the breast get this bad?" he asked. After Tissonne sent the results of her blood test, William wrote to her, "Can't F around with that," and said to get a thermography scan and ultrasound. Schutzmann arranged to have a new mattress, bed frame, bedding, and pillows sent to her. Tissonne sought more clarity the following week. She told William in a voice message she didn't want to go to the hospital unless you honestly agree that that is necessary and that you made it clear what I need to do. "Steph, it is important to have the breast looked at and cared for sure," William responded in a text. "It's always wonderful, too, that your family knows you're reaching out for care. They must be very, very worried about you, so don't be afraid of getting attention from a doc." About a week and a half later, in mid-November, Tissonne texted him the results of her thermography scan, which showed an array of elevated temperatures. She sent him more blood work, and they started discussing mammograms and biopsies. She asked him to join her on a call with a doctor she was now speaking with, and he said he couldn't. "When we talk next about my breast, can it be on the phone, and can we ask Spirit to help us see what's happening?" Tissonne asked. "Thank you." He didn't respond. She wrote again the next day after a family doctor called her with X-ray and blood results. "What is a compression fracture? I'm kind of freaking out. I need a plan. My goal and vision is that Spirit and yourself will RD and scan me and will put me on a perfect protocol, and my breast will heal itself with nothing invasive." The next day, Schutzmann texted her, "It's been super hectic the past few weeks, but I will make sure Aunt gets back to you ASAP." William never texted her again, but Casey McCluskey relayed a thought in December. "I think all the vomiting and all the immobility has just given you a ton of pain. That's what Anthony said it would be a few days ago." McCluskey says that she didn't speak to William about Tissonne specifically and that it was a general conversation. Ahmed and McCluskey say they believe Tissonne's family didn't want William involved, and McCluskey says she understood that the family took Tissonne's phone away. Tissonne texted with Schutzmann a few times the following year. Tissonne and McCluskey corresponded throughout the course of that year. Tissonne's brother says her family never took her phone away or sought to limit her contact with William. In December, Tissonne's family, now aware of the lump, took her for a biopsy. Before the results came back, she had a seizure that sent her to the hospital. Doctors induced a coma for 3 days, and she learned that she would never walk much again. She had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, which had eroded her spine. They're assuming it's tumors, which is not smart, as the radiation can cause problems, McCluskey texted her. McCluskey says she was echoing another Tissonne friend's fear. Most of the friends who took care of Tissonne after her cancer diagnosis had some tie to the medical medium world. In August 2018, one of them made a trip to the beach with her. "She always was hopeful," the friend says. William's disappearance hurt and confused Tissonne, but she kept faith that he had the answers. Her doctor told friends and family that they needed to be honest. He had been forthright about how much time she had left, and Tissonne responded by asking if someone could contact William to check. "I'm always behind you," she once texted him. "It's my purpose." In November 2018, Tissonne died of breast cancer. She was 38 years old. In her final weeks, the pain of William's absence lingered. "I don't want to die. Can you please talk to Anthony for me?" she texted McCluskey 5 days before her death. Maybe he will have a solution or something. McCluskey responded that she was sorry. She says she wasn't sure if the text was from Tusson. News of Tusson's death began to circulate. William offered another medical personality an unsolicited clarification that he wasn't responsible. A bit over a year after Tusson died, a friend wrote about her on Instagram. Sarah, a pseudonym, still mostly stuck to William's methods. She previously did work for Medical Medium and was close enough to William that in 2018 they discussed her business proposal for a health retreat that never materialized. Her father had died shortly after Tusson, and in her post, Sarah reflected on their contrasting circumstances. Her father had undergone traditional cancer treatment, while Tusson did all the healing protocols you can think of and was guided personally by William. Ahmed and Kimberly Spare, another health coach touting William's name, responded to Sarah's post by sending letters to their respective followings. Their notes covered similar ground and used much of the same language. Spare said that Tusson was not under William's care or a client of his, and advised her followers to look past Sarah's post. Vulnerability is real during healing, and the last thing we need is a story to be twisted and throw us into fear, doubt, and adrenal spiral, she wrote. After seeing the letters, Sarah aired her distress in a blog post. The only people who knew Steph that are still connected with Anthony are the ones who are making money, she wrote. Both Ahmed and Spare say they've never received money from William. Still, she remained conflicted. It was Steph's decision not to see a doctor. She's responsible for that, she wrote, but maintained that William built a relationship with her based on this mutual belief that he had perfect information about her health. She told the story of Tusson's illness and death at greater length and elaborated on Tusson's closeness with William, even if she had stopped paying for sessions. Yes, it's a fact that Steph wasn't a client of Anthony's, she wrote. But now do you see how she was so much more than that? The back and forth among William affiliates set off debates across the network of Facebook groups formed around interpreting his work. The month after Ahmed's and Spare's letters, he did a live stream on the platform. I've always known about the paid trolls out there, William said. He claimed that two women reached out to him and told him that a corporation or this entity or group or some kind of association or something contacted multiple people and offered not a little bit of money, like a large amount of money, to make up slanderous stories, tall tales, crazy claims, to weaken Medical Medium credibility. A few months after Sarah's blog post in June 2020, Ken Turkell, a lawyer retained by William who has represented Hulk Hogan and Sarah Palin in their battles against Gawker Media and the New York Times, sent cease and desist letters to her and others who posted about Tusson's death. As you probably know, Turkell wrote, as you supposedly know, Mr. William considered Stephanie to be a friend, and for you to imply that he played some role in her death devastated him. Sarah had already removed the post after the blowback. Turkell said that the record of text and voice messages would show that William had told Tusson to seek traditional care from a doctor, but did not include them out of privacy concerns. The matter began to die down. Over the last few years, as both William's celebrity glow and the online discussion of Tusson dissipated, he has settled into a life of professional proximity to fame. He struck up a public friendship with Tony Robbins. Miranda Kerr told New York Magazine that his book, Cleanse to Heal, transformed the way I think about food. In August 2020, he wore dark sunglasses as he appeared on an episode of the short-lived podcast In My Feels. Co-hosted by Noah Cyrus, the show had previously featured interviews with the life coach Jay Shetty and the business influencer Gary Vaynerchuk. William advised Cyrus to take up spirulina, cilantro, and wild blueberries. He talked about aliens on his podcast and posted a juice shot recipe for chemtrail exposure. "You can come and go as you please," William recently said in an online chat group, which you can't do in a cult. Friends who knew both Tissone and William continued to reckon with the role he played in her life, as well as the extent to which they went along with it. One recalls a maxim that William texted Tissone: "It's loving others and having compassion for others that's more important, so don't go too crazy loving yourself." "He never said this shit to me," the friend says. One practitioner I spoke to told me she abandoned her association with the medical medium after coming to terms with Tissone's death. She still keeps tabs on William on social media. "There's a new group after us," she says, "a new inner circle. Nonetheless," she says, "I still feel best when I do what he recommends." Kith and Kin, a Smithsonian exhibition explores complex bonds by Allison Schaller. Kinship is a sense of shared recognition and trust, says Leslie Urania, curator of photographs at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. That word is also the title of the gallery's winter show, comprising work by eight artists, including Latoya Ruby Fraser, Anna Shulikaris, and Jess T. Dugan. Though vastly different in terms of the topics they address, each of the artists visualizes how people relate to one another, says Urania, who curated the exhibit with her colleague in painting and sculpture, Dorothy Moss. Fraser's Flint is Family in three acts photographically chronicles Michigan residents affected by the water crisis, a human record and testimony that indicts systems that violate our human rights, as the artist says. Chilak Harris's sculpture and performance piece, Portrait of an Indigenous Woman Removed, honors the communities of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And the connection goes beyond the exhibit. In November, the gallery's annual Portrait of a Nation Gala celebrated luminaries including Anthony Fauci and the Williams sisters, a fine art communion in thanks for their service. In the photos, Latoya Ruby Fraser's self-portrait with Shay and her daughter, Zion, in the bedroom mirror, Newton, Mississippi, 2017 to 2019. The Kinship exhibition catalog, featuring Jess T. Dugan's self-portrait with Eleanor, 2018. Lara Regensdorf writes on beauty, party starter. Known for mixing elegance with the absurd, food artist Layla Gohar dips into beauty. With photograph of the subject by David Brandon Geeding. White lace curtains, relics from Greece, hang in the storefront windows of Layla Gohar's Lower East Side studio, as much a means of privacy as they are an understated calling card. Such old-world materials are a signature for the Cairo-born New Yorker, whose finely tuned food installations bring an off-kilter wit to fashion and art events. Gohar World, the line of entertaining whimsies she and her sister Nadia launched earlier this year, offers lace dresses for otherwise naked eggs. The baguette gets similar habiliment with a black satin carrier. But on a recent gloomy afternoon, Gohar finds herself in need of a pick-me-up. Today would be the perfect day for a red lip, because I'm feeling so tired and kind of scruffy, she says, which for her means a Prada chore coat, black pants, and pearls, shaped in Gohar World fashion like chicken feet. Red is assertive, she adds. There's no middle ground. Makeup, with its elements of armor, mood lift, and finesse, is front of mind given Gohar's latest project, a Baradeau collaboration called One Another, that's an invitation to decorate both table and face. I realized from an early age there is no single way to celebrate holiday, said Baradeau founder Ben Coram, who shares a cross-cultural identity, in his case India and Sweden. Everyone has their own take on what it means, some traditional, others entirely made up. As it happens, just because occasions are Gohar's specialty. A tomato celebration, a coldest night of the year celebration, a sidewalk party for no reason, she explains, ticking through a personal highlight reel. In lieu of Baradeau's usual white packaging, Gohar's custom print, with beans and braided mozzarella, dresses up gift boxes of mascara and eyeshadow. It also appears on napkins and a tablecloth sturdy enough for picnics. A special edition tea recreates a bergamot blend that Gohar sipped as a child in Egypt. And, of course, there are potatoes, a favorite food, humble and universal, here rendered in ceramic, candle holders, salt and pepper shakers, and covered in tattoos. Such juxtapositions call to mind surrealist work, like Elsa Schiaparelli's leather gloves with trompe-l'oeil painted nails, an effect carried over to a new Gohar World dishwashing glove. Another has a frilly lace cuff. The detail evokes the Cairo women whose nails gleamed like a red Ferrari, says Gohar, whose own workhorse hands are admittedly grubby. She hopes the gloves might inject lightheartedness into this mundane chore. A taste for subversion runs through Gohar's idea of beauty. My sister and I have this test when we design something. We always hold it up and we're like, is this too chic for its own good? She says with a smile. In her studio, tiny candles resemble fried chicken and pink Japanese strawberries. Nearby, a couple of marionette-like figures made from dried sausages are slated for a window display at the Galerie de Michetonnant. Gohar plans to show them alongside Maria Perguet's stainless steel ribbon pouf, a nod to the Metals Butcher Shop Associations. A moment from this photo shoot floats to mind, when Gohar mock-seriously smeared a mortadella-colored Baradeau lipstick across her face to collective laughter. When you bring my work into these settings, people become a little uninhibited. They kind of become like kids, she says of the icebreaker. Even at a dinner party, that's the mood to strike.
Thank you.
the firebrand. SCOTUS is in a right-wing chokehold, but a liberal conservationist judge blazed the activism trail by Douglas Brinkley. Opening photo, Robert F. Kennedy and William O. Douglas hiking in Washington State, 1962. The conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court are considered by many to be ardent activists. And yet, truth be told, there has never been a more activist justice than William O. Douglas. Appointed by Franklin D. Roosevelt, Douglas was a committed conservationist, vocal opponent of the Vietnam War, best-selling author, would-be candidate for president, and at 36-plus years, the longest-serving high court justice in American history. With all the current hand-wringing about the politicization of the judiciary, Douglas was Exhibit A in pushing his own political agenda as a liberal, libertarian, and crusading environmentalist. By 1954, Douglas had been on the court for 15 years. A native of Minnesota and Washington State, he pursued his passion for nature and for protecting the American outdoors. Between cases, he plotted campaigns to preserve Washington's North Cascades, Alaska's Arctic, Wyoming's Wind River region, and Maine's Allegash River watershed. His criticism of the government's nuclear testing in the Nevada desert was unrelenting. From his chambers, he investigated the howling range of coyotes and the mysteries of the ruffed grouse. He liked to quip that he would have gladly traded the honor of being on the court for that of having collected ferns for Lewis and Clark. The justice sometimes wore his lug-soled hiking boots on the bench. On weekends, armed with a backpack, binoculars, and floppy hat, Douglas, compact and trim, with fierce blue eyes, would explore the backcountry of Virginia or Maryland, sometimes with his longtime protege Robert F. Kennedy as his trail mate. In the 50s, as the post-war car boom surged, an environmental crisis loomed. The vexing threat to air quality posed by leaded gas. Douglas was alarmed by the smog-shrouded dome that hung over cities like Los Angeles and New York. Decrying consumer consumption run amok, he blasted the Army for selling surplus Jeeps in the arid West, which, when driven off-road on public lands, damaged soil, streams, plants, and habitats. He encouraged fellow proto-environmentalists to use lawsuits as a weapon against the Army Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, and British extraction companies. Furious at the reckless wounding of the earth by Philistines, he would help the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society, he was a member of both, acquire pro bono attorneys for their preservationist pursuits. En route to the court, Douglas would sometimes ask his chauffeur to drive along the Potomac so he could check for traces of manganese, a heavy metal used in industrial processes that can cause neurological damage to humans and wildlife. Richard Schwartz, a Yale law professor, recalled that his friend Douglas was distraught over the way the Department of Agriculture and the Corps of Engineers operated without accountability. Douglas carped that the Forest Service was a faceless organization full of modern Ahabs, hungry for money and power, as the agency opened wild areas to roads, mineral extraction, and timber cutting. "I'm ready to bend the law," he said, "in favor of the environment and against the corporations." Spending long stretches in the North Cascades and fly fishing in Oregon brought equilibrium to Douglas's pressured life. And when his close friend in the Senate, John F. Kennedy, had a question about nesting plovers or pollution abatement, he looked to Douglas, who often teased, "The trouble is, Jack, that you've never slept on the ground." Unafraid of conflict of interest charges, Douglas turned his Supreme Court office into a way station for elite conservation groups. Douglas had grown incensed about a proposed Virginia-Maryland motorway along the bed of the abandoned Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. He charged that a paved road would create abominable traffic and ruin the towpath. The noise, he fumed, would destroy the tranquility of a hike along the old canal, a project first championed by George Washington. The National Park Service was in favor of the parkway, but wanted to ban commercial activity along the route. Douglas envisioned a meandering national parkland at the back door of the nation's capital. The opening salvo of the battle over the C&O Canal began in January 1954 with a Washington Post editorial by Associate Editor Merlo Pusey supporting the motorway. Douglas wrote the Post that a multiple-lane road would destroy the scenic Potomac Valley. The keynotes of the wood thrush would be drowned out by a cacophony of roaring wheels and blaring horns. Soon, an anti-construction sign was posted by preservationists at Shepherdstown, West Virginia. "Justice Douglas, keep to the right, booby traps to the left are for the Post editors." Douglas decided to throw down a gauntlet. He challenged the Post editorial board to hike the towpath with him, to experience firsthand the beauty of Great Falls and Mather Gorge, which the parkway would ostensibly destroy. "One who walked the canal its full length," Douglas wrote, "would get to know muskrats, badgers, and fox. The whistling wings of ducks would make silence have new values for him. He could never acquire that understanding going 60 or even 25 miles an hour." To their credit, Robert Estabrook, the Post editorial page editor, and his associate editor Pusey accepted the challenge to make the 8-day, 184-mile hike. On March 20th, a party of 37 joined the Justice. Among their number was Sigurd Olson, the director of the National Parks Association and a legendary advocate of the outdoors who had a degree in a new field, ecology. Also on hand was Olaus Murray of the Wilderness Society. A renowned conservationist, Murray would regularly correspond with Douglas about an initiative he had undertaken to stop hydroelectric dams. Reporters from Time, Life, and CBS Radio followed the delegation along the Potomac. The Washington Post covered the outing daily. The nightly news ran favorable segments. The Potomac Appalachian Trail Club of Washington supplied the team with food. Enjoying the blush of buds blooming in late winter, the group followed Douglas's pace of 112 steps per minute, marching 22 miles the first day. The New York Times dubbed them the Blister Brigade. Driving downpours and frigid wind didn't hamper the nature lovers, who encouraged gaggles of Boy Scouts, fishermen, and nearby equestrians to join their cause. Douglas's merry band encountered raccoons, woodchucks, and hawks circling for prey. Otter prints were discovered along the riverbank. One evening, some of the hikers decided to play a joke on Murray, considered the country's expert on animal tracks. Clandestinely, a Mexican burro was brought to the trail to leave telltale hoof prints. Early the following morning, Murray, upon seeing the tracks, was taken aback. Then, to the stunned group, he nailed it, saying, "If it weren't for the fact that there aren't any for hundreds of miles, I'd say it was a Mexican burro." Near journey's end, Estabrook and Pusey quit the march, exhausted. But Douglas, despite a rending cough, forged onward with eight others in scudding rain. Once back in Georgetown, his blister brigade told a welcome home party of 50,000 about eating buffalo steak and sleeping in frost-caked tents. Editors Estabrook and Pusey had a change of heart. The Post retracted its editorial, suggesting that parts of the canal should be saved as a federal park. Soon, the Park Service withdrew its support as well. Douglas's odyssey had helped derail the motorway, and in the months to follow, his widely publicized style of direct action was adopted in local battles around the country. Protest hikes were organized. Anti-dam rallies were held. Citizens and politicians were on the march. Just days before leaving office in January 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who quietly admired Douglas's feistiness, surprised conservationists by designating the C&O Canal a national monument, a stepping stone to its becoming a national historical park. And in 1975, Douglas retired from the bench at age 77, having written 30 books on travel and the environment, all published while he generated more opinions and dissents than any other justice in the history of the court. With hardly a murmur of criticism in the national press, Douglas's sustained policy activism outside his chambers is without precedent. By hiking and hollering, as he put it, his Gandhian protest and other demonstrations that followed had helped establish green belts, nature preserves, and open spaces across the land. This latter-day Gandhi, of course, wore not a white dhoti and shawl. He preferred black robes and hiking boots. Excerpted from Silent Spring Revolution, John F. Kennedy, Rachel Carson, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and the Great Environmental Awakening by Douglas Sprinkley, to be published on November 15, 2022 by HarperCollins. Copyright 2022 by Douglas Sprinkley. Articles about J.J. Redick and military matters, coming up in the next installment of Vanity Fair. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.